In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's coolest conversations time in Little Stephen's Underground Garage, presented by Hard Rock. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. My guest is noted producer Chris Wanzer. Now, he's worked with the likes of R.E.M., Courtney Love, Cheap Trick, Rod Stewart, and many others. What brings him to our attention today is his work with our very own Michael DeBar on Michael's latest solo album, It's Only Rock and Roll, which is a collection of cover tunes that have inspired and influenced Michael, featuring lots of glam rock, including our recent coolest song in the world, Fox on the Run, done originally by Sweet. Well, we'll hear a tad of Michael's version now, followed by my chat with Chris on your coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage. Manfred, and I am speaking today with Chris Wanzer, the famed recording producer and engineer. Over the course of his career, he's worked with artists like R.E.M., Courtney Love, Cheap Trick, Rod Stewart, Deep Purple, Joe Cocker, Dr. John. Worked with producers like Linda Perry and Rick Rubin, as well as many other great artists and producers. What brings him to our attention today, though, is his work with our very own Michael DeBar. Chris is responsible for producing and engineering Michael's latest album, It's Only Rock and Roll, which features this week's coolest song in the world, a version of the sweet tune Fox on the Run. Hey, Chris, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, now, do I have this right? You live out here in Los Angeles?
I do, yeah.
And whereabouts in town?
The Valley area.
Valley area. But now, where are you from originally?
I'm originally from a tiny town in Michigan called Otisville.
Where is Otisville in relation to the to Michigan, to Detroit?
Flint, Michigan, near Flint.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah.
I've never heard of that place.
Yeah. Well, so you grew up there?
Yeah. Grew up there for 18 years and moved to L.A. at 18 years old.
Well, when you were growing up, was there much music going on in your household?
A little. You know, I started playing drums pretty young, 12 years old, something like that, and started playing in bands by the time I was 15. My dad actually was, when I was growing up, I never saw him play music, but when he was in college, he made a living playing in two bands, jazz bands, one playing upright bass and one playing trumpet, which I always thought was cool, but, you know, he got out of that as, life goes on, and so he very much supported me, too, in my interest in music once I got into it.
Well, what got you starting playing drums?
That's a good question. I think I just started playing in marching band, and that was the one that I was drawn to. So I can't say that any particular record got me going, but I just got into it, and then I started diving into all the different music out there.
And so you mentioned playing like in bands in high school.
Yeah.
And I would think as a drummer, you were pretty sought out, sought after.
I was, all about, I was in that time, I was very into the 80s rock and everything that was going on, the hair metal and stuff like that, and the heavy rock and things like that. And, it's a small area. So yeah, you're right. There's not a lot of musicians. So it wasn't like today. You can't go on Instagram or Facebook or anything and find people. You had to find people just really the old fashioned way, just by word of mouth or, talking to different people in school and just finding your people.
So you mentioned when you were growing up there, Giuseppe, to the year 18. So was it at 18 that you decided just to head on out to California?
I did. I think when you're that young, you're a little naive to things. So I thought it was no big deal. People later said, oh, that's amazing. You moved out there by yourself. And at that time, that was 1988. So again, we didn't have Facebook, Instagram, anything. I can't even remember how I figured out how to get an apartment. I literally packed up a little car with my drums and drove out here by myself.
Well, what was the plan? I mean, you were going out to LA to rock?
Be a rock star. That didn't quite work out. But, while I was here pursuing that area, I slowly fell in love with the recording side.
Well, when was the first time you were actually, when you, like, for instance, when you were, before you moved out to LA, did any of those bands, the groups that you were playing with, did they ever go into a studio and record anything?
No, they're in back in Michigan at that time, there just weren't studios. It was so hard in that time now you've got YouTube videos, everything. It was just really hard to even figure out what recording was at that time. It just in 88 or was 88 when I moved, but in the 80s, it didn't really exist much back there. So we didn't record anything. It was, I think we maybe got a 4-track at once and recorded some demos, but.
All right. So you get out to LA and you got your drums and, you get your line up an apartment. I guess you were trying to get something. You had to get some sort of job to make ends meet.
Yeah. Classic. Got a job at a survey place, annoying people on the phone, calling, asking about movies.
Great.
Well, I was hanging out on the last days of the Sunset Strip. I got to experience that for two. I think it was like right around 1990 when they just shut that whole loitering thing down. But I got to experience the last two or three years of that. So that was fun.
Well, I'm angling here for us to get an idea of. So you're out here and you do make connections with people, start recording. When is the first time you're in a proper studio? And about how old are you? And then there's this transition to figuring out, hey, instead of sitting out here on this side of the glass, I'd rather be on the other side of the glass.
Yes. I played, while I was playing with these bands, I started playing around with demo recordings and things like that. And, it wasn't until my mid-20s that I started feeling interested in the recording side. And I just happened to befriend two engineers that were very notable in the business, and Robbie Jacobs and Brian Schubel. And I asked them both separately, could I, meet you for coffee sometime and pick your brain? And they helped me, get interviews at different studios. And the studio I ended up working at was Royal Tone Studios, which now is a private studio. But at the time, it was recording big artists like Don Henley. It was the first day I got the job. I was getting hamburgers for Don Henley. And I almost got fired because I got the order wrong.
Oh, no.
I want to blame it on someone else, though, for how they wrote it.
Oh, right. Well, so you start in here and you're kind of, running errands and stuff, or I guess if this was in the UK, they would have had you fetching tea. So what was like the first band or artist of if you can remember, what was the first band or artist that you ever recorded yourself as the engineer?
As the engineer. So that was, it's hard to remember exact because at that time, it's a slow grind. I started as assistant engineer, and I worked on a lot of great projects. Don Henley, some Alanis Morissette stuff early on with a lot of great producers. And then eventually you start getting the opportunities. And as I remember, I think one of my bigger early ones, you know, I assisted on Christina Aguilera's second single. And then during that time, I worked with Ron Fair for a long time, and he would give me little opportunities here and there on the different projects to work with them. And then I remember I got the opportunity to engineer for a lot of a Macy Gray record. That was separate from Ron, but some other things. But you know, there was just a slow, you just get opportunities and they start, and you build upon that.
Are you familiar with Rodney Mills?
I am not. The name.
Okay. So Rodney, you know, he was active in the 60s, and but then into the 70s came into his own, his associations mainly with or best known for his association with like Southern Rock, working with the likes of Lynyrd Skynyrd and then later 38 Special and Atlanta Rhythm Section, and did a lot of stuff associated with Southern Rock. And then later on, he did produce like the Corzados and worked as an independent producer for a short while. But in the 60s, he was, you know, a lot of, I can't remember the name of the studio in Atlanta that he was working at, but, you know, worked with Joe South. South was also like a session guy. The reason I bring him up is that he did also do a lot of R&B stuff. And at one point, had the story about recording James Brown. And this must have been like 67, 68, 69, somewhere in there. And, you know, the band, you know, he had those guys, his band, Freddie Lockstep, and they get in the control room to listen to a playback, and there are no vocals on it. And somehow this rookie mistake, I mean, Rodney had already been recording all these artists, but somehow the cable wasn't plugged into the mic, vocal mic or something to that effect, some really stupid, simple thing. And James is like, oh, you know, this sounds great. You know, turn up the vocal. And then Rodney's like, it's, you know, there's nothing there. And he tells him, hey, you know, you're not there. I don't think I plugged you in, you know. And then suddenly everybody in the room is just like, you know, on pins and needles and waiting for what James is going to say. And James Brown just says, well, we'll just do it again. And everybody breathes a big sigh of relief. And they did it again. It wasn't a problem. So with you, like, what is your worst kind of rookie mistake that you made? And how did the artist deal with it? Do you recall anything?
I got very lucky working with a friend that one of the engineers I mentioned, Rob Jacobs. We were working on a record that Stan Lynch, who, you know, played drums with Tom Petty, mm-hmm. the Heartbreakers for a long time, he was getting into producing after he left Tom. And we were working on a record and Kenny Aronoff was drumming on it and he was drumming on it. Well, the day that Kenny was there, it was very exciting for me because I just looked up to Kenny a lot. And I was still pretty green in the tape machine and I threaded it wrong. And I started rewinding it or fast forwarding it, and it just wouldn't stop. And I didn't understand what was happening. And I look over at Rob and he looks at it with a look of panic, runs over, just grabs both tape machines and physically stops them. It was amazing. I was just like, what's going on here? And I had threaded it wrong. So while it was going around, it was actually cutting a groove in the middle of the tape. Like, oh no. But Rob, being the calm, great, nice guy he was, everybody was on lunch. He was like, okay, we're going to put up another tape. It looks like it's in the middle. It probably didn't hit anything, you know. And we literally just, while they were at lunch, recorded it over to another tape and just went on with our day. But man, I was like, did I just ruin all of his drums?
Wow. Okay. Whew. And no one was the wiser.
Yep. He, you know, now if anybody's listening.
Well, that was just a funny story.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you've worked on like 70. Well, this is, I mean, maybe more, but what I was reading was you've worked on 70 major label releases, 19 certified platinum, about around, you know, over 24 indie records, lots of big name stuff. Well, what's a record that you think is really, really great, but that never really got a fair shake? Something people should have taken note of, but never did, never had the opportunity to.
You know, that's a hard one for me to answer because there's so many. That's, you know, I remember in the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, you'd get these bands that were signed that were just amazing. And then just whatever happens, something changes at the label and it just doesn't happen for them. And I just, there's so many actual artists that you don't even know that that were just made some great records with great producers that just never saw the light of day. And I've been lucky to work on a lot of great, very accomplished producers and artists. And I just, it's hard for me to just kind of pick one just right off the bat.
Well, if while we're talking, if you think of one or even two, you can, you know, get the inspiration, let me know. But let's focus for on a second now for our own marquee of rock and roll, Michael DeBar. How did you guys meet?
We met through our friend Paul Ill, who actually played the bass on it. And Paul is someone in my Linda Perry world because we worked there with her for a while. That's how we initially met.
Have you ever worked with him before this project?
No, nope.
Well, how would you describe working with Michael in the studio?
He's great. He's just so joyful, full of energy all of the time. I've always been very impressed with him as a talent and just his attitude. He's just enjoyable to be around. He just lifts the room and he walks in.
Absolutely. So when and where did you record It's Only Rock and Roll?
This would have been last year, actually.
All right.
Last summer, if I'm right.
You recorded it at Paul's place in the Valley or not? Did you do it at your studio?
Yeah. Well, we partner up at this place. So yes, yeah. It was decided to do it here to keep it simple and easy.
Well, cool. So we've got Paul on the bass and drummer David Goodstein. Is he also part of that Linda Perry world?
Yeah, Linda. I mean, he is. It's interesting that him and I, during my 5 years with it, her didn't really cross paths during that time. So he was a little pre me. But then I got to meet him through Paul in this circle and really love his playing.
And who is on guitar?
Eric Skirmerhorn. He's done a lot. He's played with Bowie for several years, Iggy Pop, Sheryl Crow. He's got a nice list. He's a very, very unique, creative guitar player.
And now your relationship with him, did that come from Michael's end or from Paul, or had you worked with him?
I knew him before Michael. That actually is another one from the Linda Perry world.
Well, cool. Well, my understanding is that you cut the album just over the course of a week, maybe like in 10 days.
Yes. It was very quick. You know, a lot of it was about preparation. And then we really, the actual main basic tracking, which we did very live in the old school way. I like to call it the traditional way more. But we knocked that out. If I remember right, it was 3 days. 3 days.
Well, cool. Well, wait a minute. You said, instead of saying old school, you prefer the term traditional?
I don't know why I do that. I just feel like I just always love the feel of tracks that are recorded as a band as opposed to doing the overdub process that's done a lot nowadays.
Oh, no, I agree with you 100% with that. It's just funny, the actual term old school versus I'd rather say traditional than old school. It's like, man, I don't know. I get tired. I'm old with the old school. You know, let's think of something. Traditional sounds a classic sort of, you know, a real thing. You think of a studio, you think of guys going into the studio and playing music together, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's always got an energy that way.
Well, let's think here for saying, you know, you acted as producer. Is that right?
Producer engineer.
Well, what is the role of a producer? Your idea of what the role of a producer is, and then how did you apply that to working with Michael?
Every situation is different when you're a producer. Sometimes you're very involved with the songwriting, the arranging, everything. There are certain times where a good producer is there to just facilitate a good situation for a lot of talented people like these guys. To really just make some magic in the studio. And in this situation, it very much was that. I had my points where I stepped in and I had opinions, but for the most part, this one was just really set up a good vibe for them, get great sounds, make it easy for them to really just do their thing and not get in their way too much and just make sure I get a really good recording of them. And then, you know, later I stepped into the process a little more, but in the initial, it was all about just setting a space for them to just have fun and make a great record.
Was there any discussion about the song's arrangements, like how faithful or not to the originals that that Michael wanted to keep the tunes?
Yeah. It was kind of different with each one. Definitely wanted to make it our own while still being true to the originals.
Right. So the songs on the new album feature mainly sort of glam-leaning covers, but there's also Velvet Underground tune and the Stooges song. Did you have any idea what Michael's concept for the album is?
The biggest thing that I remember was important to him was to keep it really simple and raw, meaning just this three-piece band, guitar, drums, and bass, and not do a bunch of overdubs. So we did minimal overdubs, like, you know, some background vocals, some percussion. But I don't think, if I remember right, I don't think we did any guitar overdubs. It's what the tracking was.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. And I think maybe you alluded to this earlier, but I just want to follow up. Was there much pre-production, and were you involved with that?
On this one, the pre-production, I was more involved in just discussing with Michael, the direction, but they actually did their rehearsals separately coming up to it to just figure out their arrangements. I came in towards the end to check them out, but there was really not much I had to say. They did a great job, obviously.
Right. So. Well, was there any, while they were in the studio, was there any sort of change of course? Like, were there any songs that... they felt like we're going to turn out great and we just weren't coming together and vice versa. Maybe there was something that they had sort of low expectation for that turned out really well.
Actually, it went really smoothly. We were just, once we started recording and listening back, they were all feeling great. It was a very smooth session. I mean, I'm sure if I think back really hard, there are a few moments where we sat and discussed tempos or changes in a bridge a little bit or something like that. But it was very minimal. I remember it being... just very smooth, just great. Those were great, two great takes. Let's just figure out which is the best one and move on.
Oh, well, how many, on average, were there more than two takes? Like, you know, because I know there's certainly a point of diminishing return, right? And you don't want to get, like, especially as you as a drummer, you don't want to get the guy worn out. But you want to kind of make sure that it's played right and that there's this great energy level. So on average, well, how many takes for each song?
Absolutely. No, I always pay attention to that. And I always know in my head when we've got the take. But I always respect that the musicians want to do another take because, you know, they know what they want to get out of it. But there's some points where I pull the plug because I'm like, I know we already have it. And I know now we're starting to, like you said, diminishing returns. But on this, I would say we definitely did the classic three takes of each song, sometimes only two. I don't really remember any going past three takes.
Oh, cool. Well, all right. So our coolest song in the world this week is Fox on the Run, cover of the Sweet song. For Sweet, I actually had a top five hit with it here in the U.S. back in 75. Did Michael give you any insight as to why he wanted to do this song, this tune?
Just, you know, everything here, he just wanted to represent a time and space in music and kind of present it to the new kids, the kids who haven't heard this music. So I just think, I don't really have an exact answer for that. So.
Well, right. Well, I guess in overall, it's sort of, Michael was active in the early 70s with his Silverhead and Detective. And this is kind of the music that was in the air as he was in his full-blown, rock star years there early on. Do you have any favorites on the album?
You know what? Here's the one that's my favorite. I always like because it's a little obscure. I had never heard it before, but the song called Dynamite.
Oh, yeah. The opening track from Mud.
Yeah. Yeah. I just when we started doing that, I love all the others. I definitely I listened down to it again this morning and really connect with a lot of them. But for some reason, that one's just it's just kind of a fun, just radio hit in a way to me.
Right, very cool. So I know that you worked. Did I see that right? You worked with Rod Stewart at some point, right?
Yeah, that was in my assistant days. I got a little bit of engineering time during those days. But yeah, there was a decent period of time where on and off I got to work with him.
Oh, that's cool, because on the album Michael covers that Faces tune, "Stay With Me."
Yes.
And he uses the Stones tune "It's Only Rock and Roll" as the title track to the album. You've worked with so many incredible people in the industry, but have you ever had any connection to the Stones? Are there people in their camp?
I wish I had. You know, I've gotten lucky to work with a lot of amazing people, and there's just still those few that are like, oh, I never got to, or I maybe came close to working with, but didn't. But nope, I love the Stones, but never got the chance.
Well, while we're talking, what is something that you're working on right now that you're pretty excited about?
Right now, I'm just working with a couple of young alternative artists. I'm pretty diverse, so I'm always working on all kinds of projects. Several of the projects I'm working on right now are actually kind of new projects that are similar to this project, where it's a group of people coming together, forming a band.
Yeah.
They're not really out there in the open yet, but the artists are very notable artists, you know, the musicians that are on the projects. We did have a release this last week for a band called War Horse that is Chandler from Blues Traveler.
Oh, okay. Wow. All right. Well, tell me about War Horse. What do they sound like?
There's a little bit of a jam band aspect to it. There's a little bit of alt country aspect to it. A little bit of Blues Traveler feel to it. So it's, you know, it's a little mishmash of different genres.
Well, very cool. Well, Chris, I want to thank you for talking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Thank you.
Well, all right. So we'll give a listen now to the title track to Michael DeBar's new album. Here's "It's Only Rock and Roll" in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
If I could stick my head in my heart, spill it all over the stage, would it satisfy you? Would it slide on by you? Would you think the boy is strange? Ain't he strange? If I could win you, if I could sing you a love song so divine, would it be enough for your cheating heart if I broke
us that it's only rock and roll? That was our very own Michael DeBar with a portion of the Rolling Stones song. For Michael, it serves as a title track to his latest solo full-length. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Michael's producer Chris Wanzer for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza and Kurt Baker for producing and editing. Sony Music and the Dean Martin Family Trust, they've teamed up to release a Dino holiday tune. It's a version of "It's Beginning to Look a Lot Like Christmas." And to tell us all about those Martin family Christmases of yore is his daughter, Gail Martin. She'll be my guest next time around on your Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Feelings weren't front on the page. Wouldn't satisfy you. Wouldn't satisfy you. Wouldn't you think the boy's insane? He's insane.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.